Pastor asked if I might not like to bring something along the lines of evolution reputation this morning, and I told him that'd be no problem. I would like to bring something this morning that will be of interest, I feel, to everyone here, whether you've had evolution reputation in the college class or not. It's an area that I don't have time to spend a lot of time with in the college class at the present time, but it's an area that's become very, very much more important of late. And so it's one that I feel I ought to address and discuss. And it has to do with the so-called Big Bang Theory. And I'd like to title this morning, The Big Bang Theory and the Age of the Universe. I don't know if I'll have time to get to the age of the universe this morning or not. We'll see how time goes here. If not, I may be able to bring that on another time. Now, the Big Bang is the most popular theory of the origin of the universe at the present time. The study of the origin of the universe is called cosmogony, meaning the origin of the cosmos, or the universe. Cosmology is the study of the structure of the universe, and unfortunately today there's not a lot of distinction between those two areas. But this Big Bang Theory, most of you have heard of the term, has been especially made popular late by Carl Sagan in his Cosmos TV series. It's put out on the public broadcasting system. And also he's written a book by the same title. Now, Carl Sagan makes it look as though it's proven scientific fact. In fact, in several occasions he tries to make it a special point that this is all scientific fact. And he makes presentations that are rather convincing, a lot of charisma, his personality and all the rest, and a lot of mass media type gimmicks that make things look very, very impressive. I haven't seen very many of his series. I've been able to catch a little bit of it. And you can see the effect that it's going to have upon people, and I've heard a lot of people bring me comments and ask questions about it. But this whole idea of the Big Bang is full, literally full of assumptions, contradictions to the known scientific laws. So what I'm going to be talking about this morning is what do the things that we know about science, what do the known scientific laws have to say with regard to this Big Bang theory? First of all, let me give you what the basic theory says. About 10 to 20 billion years ago, all of the radiation and matter in the universe was concentrated, according to this theory, into one area. And this area is called, in some circles, the primordial atom or the cosmic egg from which everything else came. Now, the size of this cosmic egg varies with who tells the story. In earlier times, they said it was about the size of the solar system. So they believed that all of the matter in all of the universe was compacted into a sphere the size of the solar system. But now, today, the cosmic egg has shrunk to the size of an electron. So they're believing that all of the matter in the universe was once concentrated into a space the size of an electron. That means the trillions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars per galaxy and all the matter in them was concentrated into the size of an electron. Now, that would really be a black hole. If such a thing exists, that would be an almost infinite self-gravitation. Now, one astronomer named Alfin says that if it's ridiculous, they love it. The more ridiculous it is, now he doesn't hold to the Big Bang Theory, but he ridicules them and says that, you know, the more ridiculous it is to propose that all the matter in the universe was concentrated into the size of an electron, they love that kind of thing because the more ridiculous it is, the more they like it. Now, for some reason, this little cosmic egg developed an instability and exploded, hence the term the Big Bang. And this explosion produced the elementary particles in the course of time, and some of them go into such detail that they can tell you what happened at each billionth of a second after the Big Bang and so forth. It's all pure speculation. It's all based on mathematical models and so forth that they have no way of verifying. But during the course of this Big Bang, the elementary particles were produced, the mesons, the protons, electrons, neutrinos, etc., and photons, radiation, electromagnetic energy. Now, the result of the Big Bang was a uniformly expanding homogeneous cloud of particles. By homogeneous, I mean that it's the same all the way through. In other words, there's a cloud of particles that's expanding, and at any particular point, it looks the same as at any other point. It's completely homogeneous. And so this cloud is expanding, full of particles and radiation. Each particle was moving radially outward from the center of the Big Bang. In other words, if the center was here, all the particles are moving radially from that center, as they would in any explosion. Now, after a while, for some reason, this expanding gas began to condense and condense into rotating masses of gas by gravitational forces and so forth, within which the gas is condensed into stars and sometimes into planets rotating around the stars. And then as the stars began to contract by gravitational attraction, they began to heat up, and as a result they got hotter and hotter and eventually got hot enough to start the nuclear fires or nuclear reactions, and at which time the heavy elements supposedly were built up as a result of nuclear reactions within the stars. Thus the universe came into being. Now Harlow Shapley, who is another famous astronomer and also apparently has been a supporter of a lot of communist front organizations and so forth, he says, given enough hydrogen and the basic laws, we can explain the universe completely in all of its details and be done with myths and fables. So all you need is hydrogen and the basic laws of nature, and you can account for every little detail of the universe. That's what he believes. Now, what proof do they offer, those that hold the Big Bang Theory, what proof or evidence do they offer that this supposedly took place? Well, when it's all boiled down, there are two areas, two facts that they allege support the Big Bang Theory. The first of those has to do with the expansion of the universe. Now, observations indicate that stars and galaxies seem to be moving away from us at very high speeds. The farther away they are, the faster they're moving. Now, this results in what's known as Hubble's law, which says that the velocity of a distant object is a constant called Hubble's constant times the distance from us. In other words, the farther away it is, the greater the velocity is moving away from us. And things that are closer aren't moving away quite as fast. Now, you might ask the question, how do we measure the velocity of a distant star? Obviously, when you're looking at stars and things at night, you don't see an awful lot of movement. You don't see them moving around relative to each other. Well, the way that the velocities are measured, especially from distant stars like this and galaxies, is by means of something called the redshift. Now, I won't be able to go into a lot of detail here, but the redshift has to do with the light that comes to us from these distant galaxies. Now, most of you have experienced the fact that if you're standing in one location and a car passes by you, or a train, say, passes by you, the sound from the train increases in frequency as it's approaching you, and then as soon as it passes you, you hear a sudden drop in the frequency of the sound. This is called Doppler's effect. This results from the fact that when the train's coming toward you, the sound waves that are coming from the train are traveling toward you with the speed of sound plus the velocity of the train, which means that they are moving a little bit faster, and so your ear picks it up as a higher frequency. Then when it moves past you, it's moving away from you, so the sound is coming to you with the velocity of the train minus the velocity of sound minus the velocity of the train, and so you get a little bit of a drop in frequency. Now, the same thing happens with light. And there, a galaxy, let's say, that's moving away from us at a tremendous velocity, when it's radiating light, from the time that one wave of light is radiated, the galaxy has moved a certain distance. And this has the effect of causing the waves to stretch out. It's like they're taking the wave pattern and stretching it out, which results in a longer wavelength and results in a lower frequency or a lower energy of wave. Now, the red end of the light spectrum is the lower energy end, and the blue end is the higher energy end. You've got a higher frequency, shorter wavelength on the blue end, and a lower frequency and a longer wavelength on the red end. Now, if an object's moving away from us, the light from that object is going to tend to get stretched out, and it's going to appear to redden somewhat. It's going to move toward the red end of the spectrum. And how far it moves toward the end of the red end of the spectrum is determined by how fast the thing is moving. So that redshift that's observed for distant galaxies when compared to the spectrum of the light that it would be normally has been offered as evidence for the expansion of the universe and the fact that the galaxies are moving away from us. We'll talk about that redshift a little bit more later on. There are other interpretations for the redshift besides the Doppler effect, which can affect this whole thing. So that's the first point, that the universe does appear to be expanding. The redshift seems to indicate that galaxies and stars and so forth are moving away from us. And the farther away they are, the faster they're moving. The second point has to do with a so-called background radiation. Now, George Gamow predicted that there would be a residual background radiation all throughout the universe that was left from the original Big Bang. In other words, the big boom that took place at one time would leave some residual radiation that still should be detectable all throughout the universe. And it should be isotropic. That is, it should be the same in every direction that you look. There should be some background radiation. He made predictions that there should be a background radiation of about 3 degrees Kelvin if it were a black body radiation. You don't need to worry about all the details of that. Some of you can relate to this more than others. Now, in 1965, Andrew Penzias and Robert Wilson of the Bell Telephone Laboratories made radio astronomy observations that led to the discovery of a very weak isotropic background radiation, and it corresponded to a black body radiation of about 3 degrees Kelvin. Now, that discovery was the thing that really switched people over to the Big Bang Theory and made it the most popular. For a while, people gravitated between the so-called steady-state theory and the Big Bang Theory. Maybe some other time I'll tell you about the steady-state theory. That one's really bizarre. But you have to believe that matter is being created continuously out there in space someplace to replace the other matter that's expanding. And we're not told how it's being created, it just is. Now, but that view is less popular right now. Maybe another 10 years from now, that'll be the most popular view, and I'll have to bring a talk on that one again. Now, this discovery, the background radiation, though, really led to a widespread acceptance of the Big Bang Theory. It seemed to be really confirmed by that evidence. So on the basis of these two things, the expansion of the universe and this background radiation that's been detected, the Big Bang Theory rests. Now I want to talk about some of the problems with the Big Bang Theory and give a critique of it. And there are many, many problems with this idea. I won't have time to bring them all here, but I can refer some of you to some information that's published by the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Harold Flusher, who is a professor of physics at University of Texas in El Paso, and he's also teaching the graduate program at the Institute for Creation Research in Physics, has done a lot of work in this area of the astronomy and the age of the universe and so forth, and he's put out a number of technical monographs on the subject. These are rather technical books, so I don't recommend them for the average person. If you know some calculus and have been through some mathematics and so forth, fine, but if not, I think you'd probably be wasting your money if you invested in them. But there are other books that are available, but much of the information I'm going to be bringing you comes from these books. One's called The Age of the Cosmos by Harold Flusher, The Origin of the Universe and Examination of the Big Bang and Steady-State Cosmogonies by Harold Flusher, and The Age of the Solar System and a Study of the Poynting-Robertson Effect that I may get a chance to mention here a little bit later on, too. Now, let's look at some of the problems. First of all, considering the so-called initial state before the Big Bang took place, the question is, how could all of the matter in the universe occupy such a small space? I mean, really, stop and think of it. How could all of the matter that we know of, I know there's a lot of strange things in particle physics, and I was involved in that to a great extent myself, but this really stretches my imagination to believe that all of the matter in the universe was concentrated in the size of an electron. And, of course, the question is, why wouldn't it have become a black hole? If we believe in black holes, why wouldn't it have become a black hole and just remained steady, and that would have been it? All you'd see is black everywhere. But, you see, the question is, they sometimes claim that it was stable, and so it stayed there for quite some time, but then an instability developed. Now, this really taxes all of the laws of physics. If you're going to be dealing only with the laws of physics, you can't have a stable system, and then for some completely non-existent reason, the thing develops an instability. Now, we can have stable systems and have instabilities only when some outside force acts upon it, according to Newton's laws. Now, of course, when you present things like this, they'll usually say that the modern laws of physics, the present known laws of physics, do not apply to the cosmic egg. Of course, you'd have to say that because it would be impossible even to have such a thing if the present laws applied. So you get around that by just saying the laws don't apply. And then you can make up any laws that you want. And, of course, that's what happens. Now, if the thing was unstable, intrinsically unstable, then how can we account for it being there at any time and building up all this tremendous mass and without exploding, even before? If it was unstable already, you would never have expected it to get in that state in the first place. And then, of course, the question that always comes, where did the cosmic egg come from? Evolutionists always have this problem. You know, you trace it back to something way, way back, and then eventually you come to the question of either something always existed or something came from nothing. And with the Big Bang Theory, it's generally assumed that that cosmic egg was there all the time, or that there's another modification of this theory, and they're really hoping to confirm this, of the idea of a cyclic universe. They would claim that the cosmic egg came from a previous universe that contracted, you see, and their idea is that the present universe is expanding, and eventually it's going to slow down because of its own gravitational pull and the mass that's in it, and it'll begin to contract. And it'll contract and contract and get back down to the cosmic egg, and then it'll blow up again, and we'll start all over. And so they have an eternally cyclic universe. Some are really trying to confirm this. The problem is that there's not enough mass, as we can observe in space, to cause the thing to contract. And this is the so-called problem of the missing mass. You may have seen some articles in newspapers and so forth about this. They're trying to find the missing mass. Why? Because if they find the missing mass, then they can believe that the universe will someday contract again, and then they can have this cyclic universe and get rid of the problem of having to account for where the original cosmic egg came from. Of course, that really doesn't solve the problem. It just puts it back. You know, now you've got to believe that matter always existed and is eternal. And you're stuck one way, and man can't really conceive of that anyway. But the fact is, some are postulating that there's a lot of little black holes out there that we cannot see and cannot detect where all the mass is concentrated. But if that's the case, there would have to be enough black holes that we should be seeing stars being sucked in and galaxies being eaten up all the time if there were that many black holes out there. And we don't observe that either. Now, so there's the first problem. How can we account for all the matter in the universe being in such a small place unless we completely, radically change all of our views of the laws of physics, which, of course, they have to do. Then there's a second problem. This is a very interesting problem. It's one that I worked on when I was at the University of Washington in undergraduate physics. And I did quite a bit of reading on it at that time and still came up with no solution. Nobody else has. And that has to do with the problem of antimatter separation. Now, according to the Big Bang theory, matter as we know it now formed in the Big Bang from tremendous releases of energy. Now, we know in a laboratory that you can take energy and convert it to matter and matter to energy and vice versa. You can take a gamma ray, very high energy gamma ray, and cause it to interact in such a way that it will produce a positron and an electron. In other words, you'll get matter from energy directly. But when that happens, you always produce the matter in pairs. You always have a particle and a corresponding antiparticle. Now, antimatter is matter that has the same properties as ordinary matter, except in the reverse. In other words, the charges are all negative, the spins are all reversed, and so forth. And what happens when you get matter and antimatter together is that they annihilate one another and produce energy. Now, here's the problem. In our primordial egg, first of all, you have to account for all the matter and antimatter being in there, or at least shortly after the Big Bang, when the matter was formed. According to these Fermi-Dirac equations, there would have had to have been antimatter formed in equal proportions. In other words, for every proton, you'd have to have an antiproton. So as this matter is forming, you've got matter and antimatter mixed together in this cosmic expanding gas. Now, you might be able to account for it staying separate if it's all on radial motion and every particle is separate from every other particle. But if you're going to get a universe out of that, and if you're going to have these things condensed together, then as soon as any of these things would begin to condense, they would annihilate one another and produce energy. Because there would be an average of the same amount of matter as antimatter all through the whole homogeneous gas. Now, unless you can find some way of separating the matter from the antimatter in the expansion of this gas, you're never going to get a universe. There's no way. You'd violate every law of physics that we know. And so you've got to have some sort of cosmic sieve out there that's separating the matter from the antimatter, and such a thing is an impossibility. Nobody's ever been able to work out such a means by which these things would be separated. So there's another problem. You could never have gotten the universe on the basis of the Big Bang because of this matter and antimatter separation problem. Now, another point is that we know that antimatter exists, but it's very rare in the universe that we know. Most of it's matter. So the question is, where is all the antimatter? Where did it all go? Some suggest that some of the galaxies out there that we are seeing are actually antimatter. That's possible because we really can't tell from the light alone what it is. But still, if there are antimatter galaxies out there, the question is, how did they ever get formed? How did we separate the matter from the antimatter? Why didn't the whole universe annihilate itself and there would be nothing left but energy? Now, another problem has to do with the problem of rotational motion. Now, most of you, I think, are aware of the fact that the Earth revolves around the Sun, the Earth rotates on its axis, the Sun rotates on its axis, all the planets are rotating around the common center, and the solar system itself is rotating with reference to our galaxy. The galaxy itself is rotating, and all the other galaxies are rotating, and clusters of galaxies are rotating. There's rotational motion all throughout the universe. The problem is this. How can you get rotational motion from a cloud of expanding gas in which every particle only has radial motion? In other words, all the particles in the Big Bang are supposed to be moving, according to their theory, in radial motion outwards from the direction of the Big Bang. Now, if you have that, you don't have any rotational motion. And the question is, how do you get rotational motion started in such a situation? And the answer is, there isn't any way. You'd be violating the laws of momentum, angular momentum, and so forth to do that. Now, some have suggested that there were vast eddy currents developing in the expanding cloud, turbulence and eddy currents and so forth. The problem is, how do you get eddy currents? Now, you can understand if something blows up in air, for example, where you already have particles in the air for the thing to hit and knock against and so forth and collide off of, that you could perhaps get eddy currents in a situation like that. But this is supposed to be expanding in a vacuum. And when you have it expanding in a vacuum, you're not going to have any way of getting any kinds of eddy currents. Unless you've got some matter out there or some sort of forces or interactions separate from the Big Bang, you can't get any eddy currents. Now, they don't want any forces separate from the Big Bang because that brings God into the picture, you see, and they don't want that. So they want to do it strictly by means of natural processes. Well, if you're going to be limiting yourself to natural processes, there isn't any way to get any eddy currents. And even if you got eddy currents, they would tend to balance one another out anyway in order to conserve all the other laws, and you would never get any net effect. So why is it then that we have all of these rotating masses? We have this rotational motion consistent all throughout the universe. This idea of eddy currents is pure fantasy, you see. There's no physical reason for them to develop in a vacuum space. And there wouldn't be any interactions possible that wouldn't cancel each other out. So there's a serious problem here. Then we have the problem of the condensation of the expanding matter. Now, Carl Sagan will tell you that, you know, after a certain number of millions of years, things just begin to condense out. Have you ever wondered how that happened? Has he ever stopped to explain how that happens? Oh, they say gravitational forces took over. Well, the problem is that if you've got a homogeneous uniform gas, the gravitational forces balance. One particle is attracted by all the other particles. You don't have any net effect. That's the reason that you're not pulled all over, because there's people sitting all around you. You've got enough people around you so that there's no net effect, you see. And there's enough matter all around us that we don't have any net effect except for the Earth, which has far more mass than we do. So we feel an effect that way. But the problem is there isn't any way to develop such an isolated system. You'd have to have something to separate matter from other matter in order to ever get a situation where you could start to develop a gravitational attraction. All the forces would cancel out. A man named Lifshitz in 1946 did some calculations to show that the rapid expansion of the Big Bang would make it absolutely impossible to form nuclei of condensation, that is, to form some sort of nucleus to start collecting other particles. And he demonstrated that mathematically. Such a process could never occur. And if anything formed by random chance somehow in some bizarre way, it would break up too soon. It would break up immediately. So you have no way of resolving this problem. And we're just told that that's the way things happen, and you just believe that. You've got to take it by faith, because none of the laws of physics would ever do that. When we see, even on this Earth, when you see a gas expanding in a vacuum, it goes and fills up the whole space. It doesn't walk over in the corner and all sit in a lump there. It doesn't happen that way, you see. If you saw such a thing happen, you'd say you'd seen a miracle. And you would have. And that's what we have seen in the creation of the universe. All right. And again, if these things began to condense by gravitational attraction, how are you going to generate the rotational forces? Where are you going to get your torque? Where are you going to get your angular momentum? There just isn't any way from the laws of physics that we know. Now, another problem has to do with a hierarchical structure in the universe. Now, within the universe, we find stars, we find clusters of stars, and we find galaxies that are made up of the clusters of stars, and then we find clusters of galaxies, and then apparently we even find clusters of galaxies, and who knows how far it'll go. In other words, there's structure and order to the entire universe on every level. Now, if you're going to believe that this all came about by a random associations of particles and gases and so forth, then you're going to need, if there's trillions of galaxies in the universe, you need a trillion rotating clouds out there. And then within those trillion rotating clouds, you need other rotating clouds for the clusters of stars. And then within those rotating clouds, you need other smaller rotating clouds, 100 billion of them per galaxy, for the stars to form. So we're not talking about just the probability of this happening once, of getting some rotational motion. You've got to have it trillions and trillions times billions of times in order for this whole thing to work out. And isn't it odd that they all seem to be forming the same way and identical groupings all over the universe? Could chance fluctuations produce such order? Absolutely not. Violates every law that we know. We'll talk about the second law of thermodynamics in a bit, too, in regard to this. Now, here's another problem. This Hubble constant that's been published, according to what I've read just recently, they halved Hubble's constant, which means the age of the universe shrunk in, by a factor of two. In other words, the age of the universe is only half what it used to be. Overnight, it just changed. You know, we lost 10 billion years overnight because they changed the Hubble constant. But the problem here is this. Hubble's constant is an average. And if you were actually to take measurements on individual galaxies, you get different values for Hubble's constant, which means, since Hubble's constant is related to the time since the Big Bang, that if you were to project all the motions of the galaxies back to their center, they would not all meet at the same time. You see, if the Big Bang is true, they should all meet right at the same time. But if you project their motions backwards, they do not meet at the same time. So how do they resolve that? They take the average of the motions, assuming the Big Bang, and assuming that they made experimental errors or something on the rest of it, and so they just take the average, and that way it makes come out okay, you see, as long as you take the average. But if you actually take the actual data that we have, where there's no evidence that all these galaxies would be projected back to a Big Bang, and if they're going to say that it's experimental error that resolves the problem, then if their errors are so great as to not be able to tell that whether they all came back at the same time or not, they have got no proof that they did come back at that time. They're admitting that they've got that much error, they've got no proof for their point. Okay. Now, the whole scheme of the Big Bang flatly contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. Most of you that have been around me for any length of time know about the second law of thermodynamics. And let me just repeat one facet of it, the major point here. According to the second law of thermodynamics, in an isolated system, entropy or disorder increases. If you leave any system to itself, isolated from other ordering agents, it will decay. It will move toward disorder and disarray. Most of you are very, very painfully aware of that with your automobiles and your houses and everything else. Now, this Big Bang explosion would hasten the increase in disorder. Any explosion will always increase disorder, not order. And in all common experience, explosions produce disorder. And the bigger the explosion, the more disorder. When was the last time you heard of an explosion that produced something useful? It doesn't happen. Order gets disintegrated in explosions. Now, the second law says that there is a time direction, you see, to all natural processes. Processes move irreversibly in one direction, and that direction is toward increasing disorder. Excuse me. Let me give you an example. We know that energy gets dissipated into a form which makes it unavailable to do work whenever we try to do anything. That's why machines are not 100% efficient. Some of the energy that you put into the system always goes toward heating up the environment, friction or something else, which is irrecoverable. You cannot recover that energy for useful purposes. Now, the laws of conservation are still preserved. You've got the same amount of energy coming out as you had putting in, but much of the energy has become unavailable to do work. Let's consider an example. Suppose you're driving along the road and you have a brick, say you're driving along at 35 miles an hour, and you drop the brick onto the pavement. The brick will begin to slide because it had that same speed that you did, and it'll begin to heat up, and friction will cause the energy of the brick's motion to be transferred into the pavement and heating up the pavement and the brick. And eventually it'll come to stop. Now, that's all perfectly understandable. We would not be surprised at all by observing such a thing. But you would be surprised if you were walking by the road one day and saw a brick on the road, and it began to all by itself suddenly accelerate, and accelerate up to 35 miles an hour. You'd say you'd seen something strange, you see? Now, the first law would not be contradicted by that, because if the brick were able to absorb the heat from the pavement and convert that somehow into motion, the first law of thermodynamics would be satisfied. You'd have the same amount of energy in the end product as you did in the initial. But you know that it would never operate that way, because the second law of thermodynamics tells you that such processes only go in one direction. They go in the direction from order to disorder. And the energy moves in a state from being available to do work to being unavailable to do work, not vice versa. You can explain your pen dropping on the carpet, you see, and the energy from the pen, the potential energy from the gravitational field is converted to kinetic energy, and then it hits the floor, and it's converted into heat energy and a shock wave and so forth and transmitted throughout the floor. And you can understand that, and the pen lays there on the floor. But you don't expect the pen to absorb energy from the carpet and from the floor and everything else and then jump back up into your pocket. You would never expect that to happen, even though the laws of conservation of energy would be satisfied in both cases. Okay. Now, what does this have to do with the universe? The universe now has a great deal of order. We find galaxies, clusters of galaxies, arrangements, rotational motion, and bound systems and so forth. We find a great deal of order. But the cosmic egg state had much less order. And as soon as the Big Bang occurs and you have this homogeneous expanding gas, that's far less order. In other words, that's about the most disordered state you can have matter in is an expanding homogeneous gas. In fact, that's the direction the universe is presently moving toward. It's moving toward an expanding homogeneous gas because stars are burning out, particles are being emitted, and so forth, and eventually, according to all the laws that we see, the universe would reach a state of heat death in which you'd have an expanding uniform gas. That's the most disordered state that matter can be in. So the evolutionists are telling us that the most disordered state that matter can be in resulted in the most ordered state that matter can be in by natural chance processes. What I'm saying is that the processes that we know, the laws of physics that we know, predict the opposite. And we can observe the opposite. We can observe order moving to disorder. But we've never been able to observe order going, disorder coming into order unless you've got some intelligent directed agency that's accomplishing the work. Okay. Now, the second law of thermodynamics then is completely violated at every step in this process if the Big Bang is the way the universe came about. They say chaos to cosmos, from disorder to order, but we observe cosmos to chaos. That's what we observe all around us. To say that the Big Bang resulted in a complex universe is like saying that an explosion in a lumber yard resulted in a house. If you can believe that, then you can believe in the Big Bang. Now, again, another problem has to do with this whole story of stellar evolution. You've probably heard or seen diagrams or heard from time to time them talk about how stars evolve from one type to another, and they go through the sequence and the colors and sizes and so forth, and show you that a star will start out this way and it'll end up this way and it'll become a black hole or a burned out cinder or something, or it'll have a supernova or something. That'll be the end result. Now, this whole sequence of stellar evolution is based, again, purely on speculation. We don't have a particle of evidence that any star has evolved from one type to another. All we can see is that there are different types of stars. And we can make measurements on those stars. We can make a relationship between the brightness of the star and its temperature and things like this, and we can plot graphs. But that does not mean that a star moves along that graph in a certain sequence. We've got no proof of that whatsoever. And, of course, evolutionists, if you present that to them, say, well, and you ask them why we haven't observed a star evolve from one type to another, well, they'll just say it takes so long that we would never have been able to observe it. Well, that's very convenient, because now we get it out of the realm of the observable, and you're just supposed to believe that this happens. It just happens too slow to see. We have no proof that any such thing has occurred. Now, we have observed some changes in stars, things like supernovas, where stars have exploded. We have observed that. But what is that? That follows the laws of thermodynamics. That goes from order to disorder, you see. We find decay in the universe. We see it all around about us, in this earth and in the stars themselves. I believe that that's a result of the curse. I believe the reason stars are blowing apart and things are falling apart is because of the curse upon man. And there's a lot of biblical reasons to support that. But from a scientific standpoint, we have observed decay, but we have not ever observed a cloud of gas condensing to form a star. Such a thing is a physical impossibility. Neither have we observed any other solar systems. Now, Carl Sagan usually gives some figure. I can't remember what figure he gives, but he figures that there should be a certain number of planets that would have the same conditions as the Earth in order to support life, and then naturally, of course, life would have evolved on these other planets. In other words, he believes there's life on other planets on the basis of these speculations. The problem is this. We have never observed any solar system, planet, or anything else aside from those in our own solar system. We can speculate that other stars might have planetary systems, and they may, but we have no proof of that. We have no observational data to confirm that. So anything that's said along those lines is pure speculation, pure guesswork. And, of course, this is being offered as fact because so-and-so says so. And there is absolutely no shred of actual concrete evidence for that. It wouldn't surprise me, to be honest, that there were no more other planetary systems, if this was the only one. I don't know what God did. I can't tell what he may or may not have done. But I don't believe that there's life on any other planets other than this one in this universe. Okay. Now, some claim that the universe will eventually slow down, collapse, and start over again, this cyclic universe idea. And as I mentioned, The problem is that the mass is missing. We haven't been able to detect it. Some thought it was cold hydrogen, but our tests have shown that there's no, it should have some radiation. We don't see any such radiation. There's no radiation from hot hydrogen in between the galaxies. There's no evidence of black holes and so forth. We just don't know where the missing mass is. They're hoping that somewhere it'll be out there so they can get a cyclic universe. Now, these and other problems make this whole idea of the Big Bang an impossibility from the laws that we know. Only taking by faith and hoping that chance fluctuations would produce such a thing could you ever believe such a nonsensical idea. And, of course, I think the real reason that people believe it is that the only alternative is creation. And if creation implies a creator, and creator implies a relationship that we have with a creator, and it implies that we better get our lives in shape, you see, and that's where the real problem comes. The whole Big Bang Theory was concocted to do away with the idea of a creator. The same is true of the theory of evolution, the same is true of the steady-state theory, or any other theory that's been suggested. And there are nothing but problems with any such theories. If you're going to be dealing only with natural processes, then there isn't any way to account for the order in the universe. Now, before I leave this subject, how would a creationist explain the two proofs of the Big Bang? They talked about the expansion of the universe and then this background radiation. Now, do we have any explanation from a creationist standpoint for those two phenomena? And the answer is clearly yes. First of all, the expansion of the universe is something that would be predicted and is very consistent, at least, with a creation model. We would expect expansion, decay, and disintegration on the basis of the second law of thermodynamics, and from a theological standpoint, on the basis of the curse upon man. Such a curse would result in the order in the universe beginning to become disordered. And we see that happen on the Earth, but there's no reason to suppose that it's not happening in the universe as well. Especially in view of the fact that the book of Romans tells us that all creation is groaning and travailing, you see. Not just this planet, but everything that God has created is suffering the effect of the curse. Now, a man named Allen in 1976 wrote a paper that showed that many different initial states of the universe, besides the Big Bang, would lead to an expansion according to Hubble's law. In other words, you do not need a Big Bang in order to account for the expansion of the universe. He showed that there are many, many, many different states of the universe, initial states, that would result in the same thing. And specifically, a created universe that was created with order that was affected by a curse would result in that. If there were any random motions in the universe at all, the laws of physics would predict that eventually it would result in expansion, and you would have an expansion of the universe, just like a gas would fill a vacuum or something of that nature. So that's no problem. That's no problem at all. One more point, though, is this. The expansion of the universe depends on the interpretation of the redshift as a Doppler effect. And there's a question with that. Other scientists, not necessarily creationists, have disputed this idea of the redshift being due to a Doppler effect, that is, due to galaxies moving away. They say that there are other reasons why light can be shifted into the red end of the spectrum. And that includes photon-neutrino interactions, or photon-photon interactions between the photons in such over long distances, could cause energy to be dissipated and cause a shift into the red end of the spectrum. Or there are possible gravitational factors also. We don't know that much about the forces of gravity. Gravity is one of the most mysterious forces of all in nature. We know less about gravity, really, than we know about the nuclear forces and so forth. And many feel that the gravity can affect light, and as a result of that, could cause a shift into the red end of the spectrum. We still don't know, you see, enough about the universe to be so dogmatic that the red shift is clearly a Doppler effect. There's a lot of other possibilities. Not only that, but there are problems with anomalous red shifts. In other words, different parts of the sun, for example, if you measure the red shift of the sun's light, in one part of the sun, you'll get one figure, in another part of the sun, you'll get another figure. Which couldn't be, since the sun is all in one place, you see. It couldn't be moving at two different velocities relative to us. And there are other problems. Some galaxies appear to be physically connected to each other, but the redshifts are vastly different, which would mean they couldn't be close to each other. So that's raised some questions with the whole interpretation of the redshift. Not only that, but recently an object was discovered that had both a redshift and a blue shift at the same time, which means that it was both moving away and coming toward us at the same time at tremendous velocities. That's an interesting one to figure out. So things like that have raised some serious questions with this whole interpretation of the redshift. And don't be surprised if in the future you might see headlines, you know, the interpretation of the redshift has been questioned, changed or something. Lots of things are going to be happening along these lines. Now, if it's a discovery that does not fit the Big Bang Theory, it probably won't be in very big print. Okay, you may have to look in the back of the paper someplace to find that one. Also, quasars, these quasi-stellar radio sources, that have been recently discovered have a very high redshift. And this has led to the conviction that they are very, very far away. However, they have such energy, and we receive so much of their energy even now, that this would make them so huge and so energetic that it seems impossible. Not only that, but some have said that there's evidence that many of these quasars are very close to galaxies. And we measure the redshift of the galaxy and measure the redshift of the quasar, and they're vastly different. And so this has raised, again, some questions with the interpretation of the redshift. Maybe the interpretation is wrong. So there are astronomers questioning this whole thing, not necessarily creationist astronomers, by the way. So the idea of expansion is really no problem, but just how much the expansion is there and just what the figures are maybe questionable because of the interpretation of the redshift itself. But another problem is this 3-degree background radiation. Actually, if you really think about it, if the Big Bang Theory were true, there should be no background radiation. And the reason for that is that radiation travels at the speed of light. And the explosion and the galaxies would be moving. Some of them get fairly close to the speed of light, but not at the speed of light, which means that the radiation would outrace, the radiation that's blown out from this explosion would soon pass up all the matter, and it should be gone. And we shouldn't be able to detect any background radiation from the Big Bang. So, and that objection has been proposed to those that hold this view, but they say that the radiation that was expanding hit against expanding space. They talk about a bubble of space that's expanding, and that space is actually finite. And they said that the radiation bounced off the expanding space of the Big Bang and then came back, and that's why we can detect it. That's quite an interesting concept, you know, if space is expanding, the question is what's on the other side of space and what's it expanding into, you see. It's really a strange way of thinking. But once you get into these cosmogonies and various concepts like this, you're off in the realm of never land anyway, really. I mean, you can say almost anything because we don't have any observations to back it up, you see. Now, Harold Schlosser feels that this background radiation is due to dust particles in the galaxy absorbing radiation and re-radiating it as a black body radiator. And if you look at it that way, he calculated that you could go from 0 degrees Kelvin to 3 degrees Kelvin in 10,000 years. In other words, it would only take 10,000 years for this black body background radiation to develop if the universe were only 10,000 years old, you see. So it can be accounted for on the basis of black body radiation, and the figures fit far better with the actual data that we observe. And as it turns out, this background radiation is not exactly the same in every direction. They used to think it was, but more detailed measurements are indicating that it's not, and that would tend to confirm this creationist viewpoint on it. Now, this brings us to the question of the age of the universe. And it looks like we'll have some time to bring a few points along these lines. Now, first of all, evolutionists need time. They're always looking for more time. If you study the history of the age of the universe, it has increased probably at a faster rate than the supposed evolutionary process is going. They've been looking for more and more time. According to evolutionists, the universe is some 10 to 20 billion years old, more like 10 now because of the change of the Hubble constant, but it might go back up again. Who knows? It'll probably go back up if they've got any justification for putting it back up. The solar system is supposedly between 4 and 5 billion years old, and the Earth, therefore, also about the same age, about 4.5 billion years. And life on the Earth is supposed to have been around for about a billion years. About the first 3 or 4 billion years, nothing happened, and then suddenly a billion years ago, things began to start hopping on the Earth, you might say. And then eventually, man, about a million years ago, came on the scene, although they're starting to push that back a little bit now, about 3 million years. Now, many indicators point to a relatively young universe. These are the figures that they've postulated on the basis of the Big Bang and on the basis of the whole evolutionary concept. But there are lots of lines of reasoning and data that are indicating a very young universe. And if we accept any of those, the Big Bang theory and the whole theory of evolution has got to go out the window because they've got to have a lot of time. If you take the time away from them, they've got nothing. And they'll be forced to acknowledge a creator. So it's worth our while to spend a little bit of time looking at this question of time itself. And there are several things I want to bring along these lines. First of all, having to do with the universe itself. There's a problem having to do with the breakup of star and galaxy clusters. Now, I mentioned before that galaxies occur in clusters. No galaxies apparently occur alone. They're always in groups. The Milky Way galaxy in which our solar system is located is in a cluster called the Local Group, and it consists of about 24 galaxies or so. Now, the problem is this. Galaxies are moving within their clusters, at tremendous speeds. In fact, the speeds that they're moving with are greater than the escape velocities of the clusters. In other words, there's a certain velocity called the escape velocity that you have to attain in order to break the gravitational pull of some object. On the Earth, you have to reach, 25,000 miles per hour, something like that, in order to break 18,000, I can't remember the figure, in order to break the gravitational pull of the Earth. You've got to have a certain velocity. And unless you've got that velocity, you'll stay bound within that gravitational system. Now, these galaxies, from the measurements of the mass of the galaxies and from the measurements of their velocities, appear to have velocities that are greater than that which would be required to keep them in, which means then that there's not enough mass in the cluster to prevent the breakup of the cluster. The galaxies are moving in such a way that they would eventually break up. Now, the question then is, how long would it take for the cluster to break up? Well, the typical breakup time is from 2 to 4 million years. In other words, given a cluster of galaxies at time zero, with the motions that we can observe, it would break up and would no longer be a cluster within 2 to 4 million years. Now, here's the problem. If the universe is 20 billion years old or 10 billion years old, there should be absolutely no clusters of galaxies left. They would have all broken up within 2 to 4 million years. And there's no way to account for that unless the universe is much less than 2 to 4 million years old. In other words, this puts an upper bound on the age of the universe. It cannot be much more than 2 to 4 million years old. Otherwise, all of the galaxy clusters would have broken up long ago. Now, 2 to 4 million years may sound like a long time, but to the evolutionist, that's no time at all. I mean, that's like putting in it, you might as well say a few seconds as far as they're concerned. That completely eliminates this evolutionary process. Now, some say then, and this problem has been presented to the evolutionists, and they say that there must be more mass within the cluster system than we can detect. So again, you get the missing mass idea. And some have postulated, again, black holes within all the galaxy clusters. But if that's the case, then if there should be enough, as many black holes as there are galaxies, and that would result, according to the theory of the black hole, in them swallowing up the matter. We should be seeing galaxies winking out all the time as they're swallowed up by black holes. Now, star clusters also is a problem. Stars occur in clusters within a galaxy. And as a cluster of stars is moving around the center of the galaxy being rotating, the forces, the tidal forces, the gravitational forces, the shear forces of the thing moving in rotation around the common center would cause these star clusters to break up as well over a certain period of time. And rarely could any star cluster last more than a few hundred million to a billion years at the most. Some could last only 10,000 years at the most. But the fact is that we have star clusters, and again, they would have all been broken up long before this time if the universe were some 10 billion years old. So again, it puts an upper bound in the age of the universe. Another problem has to do with spiral galaxies. There are many galaxies, you've probably seen pictures of them, in which there are spiral arms radiating out from the galaxy. Now, galaxies, when they rotate, the inner portions rotate faster than the outer portions. And because of this, a galaxy that had any spiral arms, because of the faster inner rotation, it would soon wind itself up and the spirals would be in a perfect circle. In fact, you can figure that it would only take about one or maybe a two or three at the most revolutions of the galaxy in order for all the spiral arms to be wrapped up and you wouldn't see any arms radiating out. Now, this would mean that at most some 200 million to within 1 billion years, all of the spiral arms would be wrapped up and you wouldn't see any. Yet, throughout the universe, we see many, many galaxies with spiral arms, which indicates that they haven't had enough time to wrap themselves up, and that these things haven't been turning long enough even to get one revolution. So again, the universe must be much less than a billion years old. Some have suggested theories of magnetic fields keeping the arms intact somehow, but calculations of the magnetic field indicate that they would be far too weak to do any good, and a lot of these things have ended up in dead ends. Now, according to the evolutionists, the solar system is some 5 billion years old. And so it's interesting to look at the age of the solar system in view of a number of criteria. One is the fact that there are comets in the solar system. Most of you are familiar with comets. And comets are objects in the solar system, probably composed of rock and dust and ice, orbiting the sun in elliptical orbits. When they get near the sun, the solar wind causes radiation effects and so forth, and we see this nice brilliant tail. Now, these comets are easily torn apart, and they're affected by the fact that they come close to the sun. And they lose much of their mass due to radiation effects and the solar wind. And each time they make a circuit, they lose much of their own mass. Now, there are two types of comets. There are short-period comets and long-period comets. Short-period means they're moving relatively fast and they come back relatively frequently, and the long-period ones take a lot more time. The average period for a short-period comet is about 7 years. They range from about 3.3 years, I think is the quickest one, to about 151 years. But the average is around 7 years. And then the long-period comets is some 100 to a million years for the average period. Now, the problem has to do primarily with these short-period comets. Because these short-period comets lose much of their mass on each trip, and they're taking trips so often, they should have all been destroyed by now. If the solar system is only 5 billion years old, and most of the astronomers believe that the comets were formed with the solar system, there should be no short-period comets at all by this time. After 5 billion years, they would have all dissipated all of their matter. Unless you make them so big that they would dominate the sun and everything else in the solar system to start with, you see, you've got to have some reasonable figures for how big they could have been to start with. Now, the average life of a short-period comet, given by evolutionary astronomers, varies. The estimates vary from 1,400 years as a low to a million years as the absolute maximum. The most widely accepted figure is about 10,000 years, which means that within 10,000 years' time, all of the short-period comets would be gone. But there are lots of short-period comets out there still, which indicates that the solar system hasn't been around for 10,000 years yet. Now, what do the evolutionists do with this? Well, they suggest that new comets are coming in someplace to replace the old ones. And there have been several ingenious theories that have been concocted. One of them says that Jupiter captures long-period comets and shoves them into smaller orbits to make them short-period comets to replace the ones that are missing. But the problem is the math doesn't work out. The orbits wouldn't be right. They would be inclined wrong. And the rate would be far too slow to help the problem anyway. And pretty soon you wouldn't have any long-period comets either. You'd run out of those. Then others have suggested that volcanoes on Jupiter spit out comets. And that, you know, every once in a while a volcano spits one out again. We've got another one to replace it. Well, the probes to Jupiter never found any such thing. And the physics of that doesn't work out. The escape velocity for Jupiter, I mean, if you think escape velocity for the Earth is high, to escape the gravitational force of Jupiter would be a tremendous thing. And the kind of force that would be required to blow the thing all to pieces before it would ever get free of the gravitational field. Another astronomer named Jan Oort said that there is a deep freeze of comets in a great distance out there someplace that we can't observe, of course. And every once in a while, gravitational perturbations cause one of the comets to be flicked out of this deep freeze and enter into the solar system into orbit around the sun. Of course, that's wishful thinking again. I mean, you can postulate any bizarre thing out there that nobody can observe and try to reconcile your theory, but by the time that one effect after another piles up, I mean, it's pretty obvious that your theory is bankrupt. Another problem has to do with meteoric dust. Now, there's a constant influx of micrometeoric dust into the Earth's atmosphere from space. And these particles, these small meteoric dust particles, are so small that they don't burn up when they hit the atmosphere. Their surface area and so forth enables them to radiate the heat, and they settle down to the Earth as in the form of dust. And we can collect this type of thing, and measurements and so forth have been made about how much dust is reaching the Earth's atmosphere per unit time. Now, we can calculate the rate of this influx, as I said, and if the Earth were 5 billion years old, at the present rate of meteoric dust influx, there should be a layer of dust on the Earth, meteoric dust, some 54 to 100 feet thick, all over the surface of the Earth. Now, evolutionists say that the reason we don't see such a layer is because erosion erodes it all away and dumps it in the sea and so forth. Well, that's reasonable. So if we look at the bottom of the oceans to see how much dust there is there, and one of the key elements is the element nickel, which there's not as much of in the Earth naturally, and comes is a very predominant element in this meteoric dust. Even if you assume that all the nickel in the dust on the ocean floors came from meteoric dust, you don't get anywhere near enough dust to account for the Earth being 5 billion years old. Now, not only that, but if you go to the moon's in the same system as the Earth, and it should have the same influx of meteoric dust as the Earth, perhaps even more because of lack of an atmosphere. And so we should see on the moon at least a layer 54 feet thick all over the surface of the moon of dust. In fact, as you recall, when they were going to send the Apollo astronauts to the moon, there was a great deal of concern about this because they were afraid that the craft might sink into the layers of dust that had been built up. And they reasoned that, of course, from the influx of meteoric dust and the idea that the moon was some 4 billion years old or so, 4 or 5 billion years old. Well, when Apollo landed, they found that there was only a very thin layer of dust on the moon, between an eighth of an inch to 3 inches maximum on the surface of the moon, not 54 feet thick. So the problem is, where did all that dust go? And you don't have erosion to account for. You don't have an atmosphere. So there isn't any place to account for where is the missing dust? Somebody answer the question, you see. Carl Sagan was asked this question one time on a television debate, I guess. He said that the moon's gravitational forces compacted into solid rock. And Dr. Slusher said that his grad students got a big laugh out of that, because that's a preposterous statement. You cannot, no matter how much gravitational force you have, you cannot compact sand into rock unless you've got some sort of liquid, you've got to have water or something to cause some bonding to take place, some chemical transaction to take place, or it would never occur. You can squeeze on sand all you want, but unless you get some sort of water or something to cause chemical reactions to take place, you're never going to get any bonding. Now, there's another effect I won't have time to discuss. We're just out of time here, but the Poynting-Robertson effect is an interesting phenomena. I won't get into the details of it. It's a little bit complex to explain, but it has to do with small orbiting particles in the solar system of the size of about centimeter dimensions and smaller being swept into the sun due to radiation effects. There are some differential radiation effects that would cause these particles to be swept into the sun. The bottom line of the whole thing is that the age of the solar system could only be about 10,000 years in order for this Poynting-Robertson effect phenomena to be as it's observed. There are lots of other phenomena, helium dating, again indicating a maximum of about 12,000 years for the age of the Earth. Carbon-14 isn't at equilibrium yet. It would only take 10,000 years for that, or 30,000 years for that to occur, and there's only enough carbon-14 in the atmosphere to make the Earth only about 10,000 years old maximum. Lots of radiometric dating evidence is indicating the same kinds of problems. When they date things with radioactive dating methods, they're supplying tremendous assumptions. And recent studies have shown that they've taken lava flows that they know how old they are. There's one in Hawaii that they know is about 168 years old, flowed in 1800 or so, when this test was done in 1968. They tried potassium-argon dating on it just to see if they get the same figure. Now, naturally, you should get a figure of about 168 years, or at least very, very small figure. They came up with figures ranging from several hundred million to 3 billion years for the lava flow that was only 168 years old. Now, needless to say, this raises serious questions about the validity of these dating methods. Same thing is happening with the uranium-lead method and dating known lava flows, both in the United States and Russia. Recent studies have shown that they're getting vastly ridiculous figures for these things, which means that any other rock that they might date that they claim is 3 billion years old, 4.5 billion years old, may only be a few hundred years old, may even be a few minutes old for all we know. Okay. Now, one last question that is almost always asked has to do with the light from distant stars. Now, light travels at 186,000 miles per second, and many of the stars are said to be many light years, and in fact, as much as a billion light years away. The reasoning then is that the light from that star would have taken a billion years to get to the Earth. The question then is, if the universe is very young, then there wouldn't have been enough time for this light to get from those stars, and we wouldn't be seeing all these stars that are so far away. Well, that question, first of all, makes an assumption. It makes the assumption that the light was not created with the star. And if God created the stars, he's going to create them to be seen on the Earth. He created them for man. So it's unreasonable that he wouldn't create the light from the star to the Earth. That's no bigger problem than creating the star in the first place. So that question resolves itself that way. Not only that, but some more interesting developments have come up. Some calculations have been made, and this gets to be very complex, so I won't even try to get into the details of it. But Moon and Spencer did calculations which showed that if light travels in Riemannian space, which is another type of space, mathematical model for space, and if the universe is in Euclidean space, that's just a normal everyday space that you and I are familiar with, light could get, if it was traveling in Riemannian space, it could get from an infinite distance to the Earth in 16 years. And so this, in other words, if light is traveling in Riemannian space, there are theoretical models, in other words, which can account for the light coming from all parts of the universe and reaching the Earth. So it can be accounted for, even from a mathematical standpoint. This gets very complex. I'm not saying that this is the case. I'm just saying that this is a possibility. There's so little that we know about the universe. It's so easy to make a lot of assumptions about things, and things get overturned and changed overnight many, many times, that there's certainly no reason for a Christian to hold to a Big Bang theory because of the light from distant stars or anything of that nature. There's a lot of possibilities. There's a lot more yet to learn about this subject. Okay, that's all I have to bring this morning, but I hope it'll be of some worth to some of you. Some of you are going to get more out of it than others, I realize. And those that want more information, more detailed information, you can see me about maybe digging into some of these books if you've got some mathematical background. But it's important for us as saints to know in whom we believe, to not be intimidated by all these theories and ideas that are being propagated by men. Most of you have got enough spiritual sensitivity to know that there's not much worth to it, but sometimes it helps to see what the scientific data behind the whole thing is, to see that as a scientist, as well as a Christian, there isn't any support for such an idea. It's based on wishful thinking. It's based on the philosophy of denying God. And if you deny God, and if you've got a creation, you've got to account for it some way. This is how they're trying to account for it. Praise the Lord for the truth. Amen.